There is a fifth dimension, beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space, and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition. It lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Dimensions, the Twilight Zone podcast. On tonight's episode, we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 13, titled Back There. Now, this episode was written by Rod Serling, directed by David Orrick McDierman, produced by Buck Houghton, music by Marius Constant and Jerry Goldsmith. In the cast was Russell Johnson, Paul Hartman, Bartlett Robinson, and John LaSalle. It originally aired on January 13th, 1961, and you can watch this episode on Paramount Plus, Tubi, Freevee, MeTV if you catch it on, or of course the Blu-rays or DVDs, which I highly recommend the Blu-rays. If you didn't get them from Santa Claus, go ahead and spend a little bit of some disposable income if you have any and purchase them. They're well worth it. As always, I say they're well worth it just for the Christmas clearness and extras that you get with it. As always, if you've listened to this program before, and at least 16 of you have, if you're listening to this, you know that there are spoilers ahead, so if you haven't seen this episode in a while, or you haven't seen it since it first aired in 1961, give it a look, pause this podcast, give it a look, come back, and take a listen to the rest of this program. And as always, if you have any thoughts or ideas or anything else, feel free to email me at dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com, and I'd love to hear your feedback. So tonight's episode deals with time travel, and time travel is one of the, if not the, my favorite subgenre of the science fiction realm of television, movies, writings, books, everything else. I've always loved the idea of time travel, even though it's scientifically an impossibility. That's why it's science fiction. If it was science fact, we'd all be traveling back in time and forward in time. But it's science fiction. But I have always loved time travel. Even when I was a younger man growing up, H.G. Wells' Time Machine, the book, the Back to the Future movies, I loved those when I was a child, or when I was a younger person, I guess I should say. I really like the Back to the Future movies, although one of the best things I've ever read was an article by a scientist who said that the original Back to the Future movie would have went completely different if time travel were possible. It would have gone completely different because Marty McFly would have spent most of his time in 1955 in the bathroom, because all he would have to do is eat one meal with some sort of meat, and he would have had severe intestinal distress due to the different bacteria that was existing in food in 1955 that doesn't exist in 1985, and it would have just completely tore his gastrointestinal tract up, and he wouldn't have been able to ever get his parents together and save the day and keep himself from not being born, because he would have had diarrhea and other maladies that would have befallen him. But that notwithstanding, I love time travel, and I love the subgenre of sci-fi that is time travel. And as a child growing up, watching reruns of Gilligan's Island, you put the professor in an episode about time travel, and have Rod Serling narrating it, it's a great day. Or so you would think. So, let's crack into this episode and see what's really going on. So, without further ado, let's have the opening narration. Witness a theoretical argument. Washington, D.C., the present. Four intelligent men talking about an impossible thing like going back in time. A friendly debate revolving around a simple issue. Could a human being change what has happened before? Interesting and theoretical, because whoever heard of a man going back in time? Before tonight, that is. Because this is the Twilight Zone. So, we get at the beginning of the episode one of my favorite Rod Serling doing the narration in the scene of the series. Russell Johnson as Peter Corrigan is sitting around a table playing cards with his other peers and fellow club men. And we pan around the room to see Rod Serling sitting in a very comfortable wingback chair, which looks a little too large for Rod Serling to be sitting in. He almost looks like a kid sitting in dad's chair. It kind of swallows him almost. It's kind of funny. But you see Rod Serling sitting in a very well-appointed wingback chair telling us about going back in time. And I find it funny that he said, whoever heard about going back in time until tonight, when Russell Johnson, Peter Corrigan, Russell Johnson from, of course, Gilligan's Island, and not a whole lot else that anyone would know him from, had went back in time earlier in this season in the episode Execution. So we've seen time travel, and we've seen time travel before in the Twilight Zone. We've seen it in A Stop at Willoughby. We've seen it in Walking Distance. And we will see it again in the future. So this isn't necessarily a new concept, but for the idea of this episode, it was a really good opening narration, I thought, and I love the way he did it, sitting in the chair in the club, you know, right, across the way from Peter Corrigan and his cronies. So you have a bunch of well-to-do men. Businessmen, we don't know what they do necessarily. We know that Peter Corrigan is an engineer, but that's about all we know. We don't really know what the rest of them do, nor does it really matter, do we really care. We know that they are affluent enough to be clubmen in an exclusive club in Washington, D.C., and maybe that's all we need to know. So they're sitting around talking theoretically about time travel, and they have a discussion about whether someone could actually change future events if they were able to go back in the past and stop something of great historical significance from happening. You know, be it the stock market crash is one of the, you know, things that they bring up. You know, if you knew the stock market was going to crash, you could pull all your money out of, you know, the market before it collapsed, and therefore you could ride out the depression and, you know, be better off than most of the people that had to go through the stock market crash. The affluent people, of course, your janitors and teachers and everybody else that was affected by things like no work, because no companies had any money because the stock market crashed. The affluent people weren't necessarily as affected Well, to say they weren't necessarily as affected, they were, because a lot of them lost a lot of money. But if you were able to pull your money out before the crash, you would have not been really affected at all. You may have had to downgrade your lifestyle slightly, but it wouldn't have been as much of a strain as it turned out to be for a lot of the people. You know, they certainly wouldn't have had to wait in the bread lines and rely on Al Capone to open soup kitchens to feed them. So we get the idea of going back in time and stopping Lincoln from being assassinated, you know, to see what would, you know, theoretically, what would change if that were to happen. So Corrigan decides to go home, and he is going to walk out of the club, where he meets one of the attendants named William, who spills coffee or tea all over his nice suit, to which, of course, Corrigan, you know, laughs it off and says not to worry, and Corrigan walks out the door of the club, the front door of the club, to sort of have a, you know, momentary dizzy spell, to all of a sudden be transported back in time to 1865. And you see subtle differences in the setting. Corrigan is now wearing different clothes. The electric lamps that were out in front of the club are now gas. And you see people in period clothing and horses and buggies going through the streets to signify that we have gone back in time. And of course, Corrigan is, you know, somewhat out of place, somewhat discombobulated, as you would be had you have went back in time almost 100 years. And he tries to get back in the club. He bangs on the wall. He bangs on the door, but nobody answers the door. And so he decides to go to where his house is. And he goes to his house and notices that it's a boarding house that has rooms to let. And so he knocks on the door. The woman answers the door. And, you know, he asks her, you know, a couple of questions. He realizes that he is, in fact, back in time. Asks her if she has a room to let. And she does. And so he goes to, he thinks about renting a room from her. And he meets another one of her boarders, who is a couple that are going to Ford's Theater to watch the play Our American Cousin, where the president will be in attendance. And so Peter Corrigan, Russell Johnson, figures out that he is in fact in 1865, and it is the night that Lincoln is to be assassinated. And so he runs out of the house and tries to go stop him. He goes to the stage, you know, the stage door at the theater, and bangs on the door. Nobody answers. And then we get a cut to commercial, where we come back and we see Corrigan being taken into a police station, where he apparently was causing a ruckus at the stage door and talking about someone's going to assassinate Lincoln. And of course the sergeant, you know, asks him, how do you know it's going to happen? And he says, I know it's going to happen, but I can't prove it's going to happen. So of course the sergeant assumes he's been hitting the bottle a little bit, and so he decides to lock him up and let him sleep it off. And a patrolman who happens to be working there with the desk sergeant says, well, you know, what if it's true? What if he might be assassinated? We should probably get somebody working on this. And, you know, the sergeant tells him, well, you know, if you want to do that, that's your own, you know, you can do it, but it's going to cost you probably your job. And if you plan on moving up and becoming somebody in the force, I'd probably shut up. And So as it goes, a very well-dressed man walks in, almost looks a little bit, as you would call it, a dandy back then, walks in, has a cape and everything, dressed out, and says that he would like to take Mr. Corrigan into his own recognizance, you know, under his own care as a doctor of the mind. He thinks that maybe Corrigan isn't drunk, maybe he's ill, and he points to his, of course, his temples, as he says he's ill, meaning, of course, Corrigan's psychotic, and he thinks he can see the future. But this man, Jonathan Wellington, comes in and decides to be Mr. Corrigan's benefactor by getting him out of prison. And he takes Corrigan back to the boarding house that Corrigan went to earlier in the episode. He gives Corrigan a glass of brown-looking liquor. Corrigan drinks it to calm down, because, of course, you know, liquor is the cure-all in 1950s and 60s televisions. That's the thing that'll calm you down more than anything. That, or as they would give the every woman of any time period in of any TV show in the time period, the quote-unquote proper sedative. So Corrigan drinks this drink. He starts talking to Jonathan Wellington. Wellington gives him a handkerchief to dab the sweat on his brow. And we come to find out that Jonathan Wellington is actually John Wilkes Booth, and that he drugged Peter Corrigan to knock him out so that he could complete his mission in killing Abraham Lincoln. So when Corrigan comes to, he comes to by aid of the woman running the boarding house and the patrolman that he met at the police station earlier. They revive him, and as they're talking, and of course, Corrigan is saying, "We've got to stop him, we've got to stop him. John Wilkes Booth is going to shoot the president." We see him take his handkerchief out, which of course has the initials JWB on it. And the boarding house woman says, you know, "John Wilkes Booth rents this room. That's who took you home. We thought you knew that." So it's the so close yet so far away idea that he was in the same room with him. Had he just not taken that drink, he probably could have, or maybe could have overpowered him and stopped John Wilkes Booth from assassinating the president. Although, considering he had co-conspirators, if John Wilkes Booth hadn't shown up, chances are somebody else would have picked up that mantle and ran with it. But you couldn't really stop that, I suppose. You know, you think you stop one, you know, it's like if there's a leak in a dam. You know, you plug one leak up, three leaks appear, you know. So Corrigan, you know, starts screaming, I tried to tell you, why didn't you listen? And he starts banging on the wall. And all of a sudden we get the wavy, dreamy sort of thing happening. And you see Corrigan again, except he's back in 1961, dressed in his regular suit that had tea spilt upon it by William the attendant. And you see him knocking on the door of the club, to where another attendant opens the door. Corrigan comes in, and he says, you know, "Can I speak to William?" And the attendant says, "There's no one, no attendant here by that name. You know, there's no one here at all by that name." And Corrigan goes back into the club, where the men that he was sitting around chatting with about time travel just seemingly moments before were now discussing the best ways to acquire and to keep wealth in today's society. And seated in Corrigan's seat is a new person named William, who says the best way to acquire wealth is to simply inherit it like he did. To which Corrigan says, weren't you an attendant here? And of course the man gets slightly miffed about it and says, dear sir, I must protest, you know. And we come to find out that William's great-great-grandfather or great-grandfather was the patrolman that Corrigan had tipped off about the execution. That man became somewhat famous around the D.C. area, got into, made a few deals in land and became a prominent citizen and made a lot of money. And that's how William got his fortune, and he is no longer an attendant at the club. He is now a member of the club, and the whole idea of him being an attendant no longer exists, except for Peter Corrigan, because he's the only one that actually knows. And so we find out that, yes, you can go back and change the past, but it may not change necessarily what you intended it to change when you went into the past. And with that, let's get the closing narration. Mr. Peter Corrigan lately returned from a place back there, a journey into a time with highly questionable results, proving on one hand that the threads of history are woven tightly, and the skein of events cannot be undone, but on the other hand, there are small fragments of tapestry that can be altered. Tonight's thesis to be taken, as you will, in the Twilight Zone. So Corrigan was to go back in time and try to stop the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Instead, he went back in time and made a family generationally wealthy. So I guess the plan didn't work out as anyone had hoped. So a great companion piece, I think, to this episode is it's on Hulu. So if you have Hulu, feel free to go and watch it. It's a great limited run series titled 11/22/63, and it's about the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and about a man in modern times who owns a diner, who in his back room of his diner somehow has a time portal to 1860, and he convinces a young man who is a friend of his, played by James Franco, to go back in time and stop the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And it's a great series. I want to say it's 10 episodes or something like that, 8 episodes, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's a limited series, and it has a definite beginning and a definite end, and it's a fantastic series. It's based on a novella written by Stephen King, so if you're a fan of Stephen King, it's a great series, and I recommend watching it. But it sort of runs in the same vein of, can you change history if you were able to, even if you had all the knowledge of how to change it, could you still change it? It's a fantastic book, and it's a fantastic series. I highly recommend both. If you love to read, it's a nice little read. And if you love to sit and watch TV, it's a wonderful program, and I highly recommend it. But back to the task at hand. Russell Johnson is Peter Corrigan, trying to stop John Wilkes Booth from assassinating Lincoln, and he fails. Now, one thing that always kills me about time travel movies, and I suppose, or time travel TV shows, and I suppose, you know, of course, having no scientific data or no personal experience to support this, it always bothers me. And I don't know if I'm alone. If I'm not, write me and let me know at dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. I don't know if I'm all alone in this, but I hate, and invariably it happens in time travel movies and time travel TV shows. Someone goes back in time or forward in time, what have you, and spends a quarter of the runtime of the show or the series or the movie like, oh, am I really in the future? Am I really in the past? Oh, am I really, is this really 1961? Oh, is this really 1985? Oh, is this really 2015? You know, even though they can look around and see with their own eyes, that stuff is not the same. But they still question, and it still takes them a quarter of the movie or television program to figure it out. And I'd like to think that, you know, they do it, I guess, to get either where they're looking for comedic situations, or they're looking for something maybe to pad the runtime. I don't know. But the idea being that they spend this much time of the program trying to figure out, oh, am I really back in time? Am I really forward in time? Is this really the future? Is it really the past? It's exhausting. I wish they wouldn't do it. I wish you give the guy 5 minutes, 10 minutes maybe, to say, oh, you know, there used to be, everybody on this block had, you know, a late model Buick or Jeep or Ford, and now everything, it looks like a frickin' Hudson Terraplane. I wonder if I'm back in time. Yeah, you are. You know, figure it out and move forward. You know what I mean? Not that it wouldn't be a shock if someone could actually go back in time. I'm sure it would be a shock, and I'm sure it would take a minute to figure it out. But I would think, by God, somebody at some point would be smart enough to be like, well, stuff is different, things have changed. It's got to be what it is. So, with that being said, let's talk about this episode. I like this episode. It's one of my favorite of the time travel Twilight Zone episodes. Again, I'm not crazy about Russell Johnson. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I didn't care for him in Execution, and I think they could have done better having someone else in it, in this role. You know, I think there would have been better actors more suited for it. And it's funny, character actor Stephen Tobolowsky, in his podcast, The Tobolowsky Files, which, if you have the ability to listen to podcasts and you like podcasts, The Tobolowsky Files is something, it's just a great podcast of storytelling by character actor Stephen Tobolowsky, who played Ned Ryerson, the insurance salesman in Groundhog Day, that, you know, tells Bill Murray to watch out for that first step. It's a doozy. And he's been in about 1,000 other things. You've seen him, and if you know you've seen him, if you know when you see him, you know you've seen him. He's that kind of guy. He's a character actor, been in a million things. And he has a podcast, or had a podcast. It's currently on hiatus, but there's about 100 episodes of it, and it's about his life in movies and television and theater, and it's fantastic. And there's one episode where he was talking about, and I can't remember the episode or who he was talking to, and they were talking about someone on screen and their acting ability, and he was telling the story about the person, and another actor on the project he was on said, oh, they must be a theater actor, or something to this effect, that, oh, they must be a theater actor because you can tell the way they overact things, because you have to in the theater, because you're not, nuance in theater has to be a lot more pronounced than it can on film or television, just because of the medium in which it's supplied to the audience. And this person told Stephen Tobolowsky, they were like, you could tell he was a theater actor. not necessarily Russell Johnson, just whoever they were talking about in this particular episode of the program. He said, you know, they said you could tell he was a theater actor by the way he overacts. And to me, that's kind of where I see Russell Johnson. He's not a bad actor, but he's not really a great actor either. Which is to say, it's a little ham-fisted, I suppose. Not to down the man. He had a decent career. I'm not saying, you know, I mean, he's certainly done well more than I have ever done and had, you know, a lot more accolades than I will ever have. But it's not a contest, so it doesn't bother me. However, I think someone else could have done better in the role. Now, who else could have done better in the role at the time? I don't know. I would like to think maybe, I think James Garner would have been fantastic in that role. Hell, Chuck Connors from The Rifleman would have been better, I think, in that role. Although at 6'6", I think John Wilkes Booth would have been a little more intimidated by Chuck Connors than he would have been Russell Johnson. But that notwithstanding, you know, we have what we have in Russell Johnson. Good or bad, take your pick. But we got what we got. But I did like this episode because I love time travel. I love the idea. And certainly I loved the, and this is not a put down, but I love the simplicity of this episode and the writing and the cinematography and the, you know, all that. And I'll discuss that later in the likes and dislikes. But it was a very well done episode. The only weak link, of course, to me, is Russell Johnson. Now, of course, if you disagree with me, write to me at dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com and let me know. Or, better yet, for anyone over the age of, say, 40, let me know who you would have put in 1961 in the episode of Peter Corrigan other than Russell Johnson. That would be a fun thing to see. Let's see who you would put from back then in the role of Peter Corrigan. I would say James Garner. Just because I love James. Who doesn't love James Garner? The man's a national treasure, or was a national treasure before he passed away. Fantastic actor. Couldn't beat him. So, with that, I suppose we should get into the bios. Now, this episode was directed by David Orrick McDearman, who also directed the other Russell Johnson time-traveling Twilight Zone episode, Execution. And he also directed A Thing About Machines, where Bartlett Finchley gets attacked by all the electrical appliances in his house. And we've seen both of them. So I don't know if David Orrick McDearman and Russell Johnson were buddies. I don't know what that's about, but it's funny that two of the three episodes of The Twilight Zone starred Russell Johnson and were directed by David Orrick McDearman. But that's not the point. If you want to listen to David Orrick McDearman's biography, go back to Execution and listen to it. It's on that episode. Same with Mr. Russell Johnson. If you want to hear about his career and whatnot that I would discuss, go back to the episode Execution, and you will hear all about Mr. Johnson. So let's move on to the man who played the desk sergeant at the police station, Mr. Paul Hartman. Paul Hartman, Hartman was born in 1904 and passed away in 1973, so he only lived about 12 years after this episode aired, and he passed away at the age of 69 in 1973. He was a dancer, vaudevillian, and character actor whose roots were steeped in show business because his father, Ferris Hartman, also known as the Ziegfeld of the Pacific Coast, was his father. Paul also worked as a silent film director. He performed as part of a family act from the age of 6 weeks and was part of a tour to Japan in the cast of The Mikado at the age of 2. After high school, he went to the University of California and worked for a brief period at the San Francisco newspaper, where he thought about pursuing a career in journalism. He left that to go back into the entertainment industry, where he became a noted dancer in nightclubs, opposite stars like Ginger Rogers, Faye Emerson, and Nancy Walker. With his wife Grace, he formed the famous ballroom dancing partnership, touring the U.S. on the vaudeville circuit and also appearing on Broadway in 1948. They had a huge hit with the revue Angel in the Wings, both winning Tony Awards as best leading players in a musical. They were the first couple, well, not the first couple, but they were a they were invited to star in one of the earliest TV sitcoms, The Hartmans, based on them, of course. However, the show was not a success, and his wife, Grace, died from cancer in 1955. Paul then gave one last stage performance before quitting the stage completely in the comedy Drink to Me Only in 1958, and he decided to then switch his gears to be more of a character actor in television and in movies. He was notably in The Pride of the Family, 1953, as the patriarch of the family, as handyman Emmett Clark on The Andy Griffith Show in the later seasons of The Andy Griffith Show, and as barber Bert Smedley in Petticoat Junction. And as I said, he died in 1973 at the age of 69. But he's one of those people, again, you've seen him in a million different things, and that's what you get. So you know him if you see him. So Bartlett Robinson played William, the man who was the attendant and then later became the wealthy peer of Peter Corrigan. He was born in 1912 in New York and passed away in 1986 at the age of 73. He was born in New York, and he was an actor known for the movies Sleeper in 1973, The Fortune Cookie in 1966, and The Spirit of St. Louis in 1957. And not a whole lot more is known about him. And last but not least, John LaSalle, who played the actor who played John Wilkes Booth, was born in 1928 and is still alive today, believe it or not, at 96 years old. This was his only episode of The Twilight Zone. He had 70 credits on his IMDb, going all the way back to As the World Turns in the 50s. Then, of course, doing One Step Beyond, The DuPont Show with June Allison, of course, one episode of The Twilight Zone, The General Electric Theater, Wagon Train, Gunsmoke, Hazel, stop me if you've heard any of these, Route 66, The Naked City, Flipper, Dr. Kildare, Peyton Place, Rawhide, I Spy, My Favorite Martian, Perry Mason, The Fugitive, and also known as one of his better and more famous roles was playing Dr. Peter Guthrie in the 1966 to 71 television series Dark Shadows. He mainly played one or two episodes, bit characters in other television shows, up until his last role on film in a television show titled A Death in California in 1985. Before that, he was on Falcon Crest in Dallas for an episode or two. Not much else is known about him, and he is still alive to this day. So, let's move on to trivia. Now, not a whole lot of trivia in this episode, which is to say, of course, this is the second episode of The Twilight Zone where, involving time travel, where Russell Johnson appears. This episode takes place on April 14th, 1961, and April 14th, 1865. Peter Corrigan mentions H.G. Wells in relation to his story, The Time Machine, which had just been made into a movie a year before in 1960. And this episode, which concerns the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, originally aired on January 13th, 1961, only 1 week before the inauguration of JFK. The assassination of JFK later had a direct impact on The Twilight Zone, as the episode Night Call, which was to have aired on November 22nd, 1963, was rescheduled for February 7th, 1964. And lastly in trivia, Raymond Bailey, who played TV's Mr. Drysdale on the Beverly Hillbillies, is seen in this episode without his toupee. Now let's move on to goofs and, you know, the mess-ups of the episode. There's just a few. When Corrigan is being on the door, the stage door at Ford's Theater, the brick wall appears to move, which of course it would because it was just a freestanding wall built on a set in a back lot. And then near the end, when Corrigan pulls out his handkerchief and looks at it, the monogrammed initials are partially covered by a fold in the handkerchief. In the next close-up shot, the initials are clearly visible. The initials are still partially covered when the camera moves back to a wide shot. Now, again, this is one of those things. Now, Serling did it in King Nine Will Not Return, where the man that went to the African desert and found his plane without the crew winds up in a hospital in New York or wherever with sand in his shoes from the desert. Well, Serling did it again in this one because when Russell Johnson comes back to the modern day, he has the John Wilkes Booth handkerchief in his pocket. And therefore, of course, bringing a piece of the past into the present or into the future if you're from the past. But beyond that, that's about it for the goofs of the episode. Not a whole lot, and kind of nitpicky at that. Nothing that you'd notice on a 13-inch black and white screen in 1961. That is for sure. So with that, let's move on to the likes and dislikes. I like this episode. I like the cinematography. I like the acting of everybody but Russell Johnson. I like the settings. I like the way it was done. Like I said before, I like the simplicity of it and the writing. This was one of Serling's better written and I hate to say that because he wrote a lot of really great things, but this was a very well-written episode. Of course it was, because it was written by Rod Serling. But it was a great episode, I think. Written, directed, you know, mostly acted. You know, all of that. It was very well done. Very well done. My only dislike, of course, Russell Johnson. Not a huge fan of Russell Johnson as an actor. Like I said, I think Stephen Tobolowsky in his podcast, The Tobolowsky Files, said it right when he was talking about that friend of his who said you could tell he was a stage actor. And I don't even know if Russell Johnson didn't do a whole lot of stage acting, I don't believe. But I can't remember necessarily his biography off the top of my head. But he certainly acted like a stage actor. And while that works in some degree, that doesn't necessarily work to me in the Twilight Zone. Because if you'll notice, there's been some episodes that, especially if you're a fan of the series and have seen the series, you know, 18 times through or what have you, like, you know, most everyone who really loves the series has, you'll see that there are good episodes that are taken down a notch or even several notches by subpar performances from the cast in the vein of overacting. So, you know, I know I'm not alone in that. So, I like most everything about it except Russell Johnson. I think someone else could have been better in that role. But, as I said again, we got what we got. So, it's not going to stop me from loving this episode or loving The Twilight Zone as a series. I still do, and I still will. But I don't care for Russell Johnson necessarily as an actor, at least not in this capacity. He's fantastic as a character actor. But as a leading man, I think they tried a little too hard to make that shoe fit, and it just wound up being sore. So with that, let's get into the casting. So if Hollywood were to call me and say, Bill, we're going to remake this episode and we're going to recast modern actors today in the roles of the episode, who would you cast in the roles of the episode? And here's what I would cast in the roles of the episode. It's going to be a little different, so bear with me. And if you have any other thoughts on it, please feel free to email me at dimensionstzpodcast@gmail.com. Let me know who you would cast today in the roles in this episode. So here's what I would do. Tim Robbins. That's Peter Corrigan. Tim Robbins is a fantastic actor. I know he's getting older. I realize that. He's somewhere in his 60s by now. I realize that. But to me, this episode, or at least this character of Peter Corrigan, I always, you know, I think someone older would have necessarily been maybe a better fit for the idea anyway, since he doesn't really get into much physical altercation other than running down the street and banging on a door. He doesn't have a fist, you know, he doesn't have fisticuffs with John Wilkes Booth, you know, in the well-appointed room to let. All he has to do is bang on a couple of doors and pass out in front of a fireplace. I mean, you know, any, you know, you don't need to be, you know, Usain Bolt physically fit to do that sort of acting. You know what I mean? So if you have a 65-year-old Tim Robbins doing it, it's not a stretch. Plus the man's in decent shape at 65, so it's not like he couldn't do it anyway if he wanted to. So, Tim Robbins is Peter Corrigan, because I always thought an older man, would be a great fit for that. And subsequently, if you wanted to switch up genders and make it, you know, make it, say, make it a woman in Peter Corrigan's role, you know, go from, you know, Peter Corrigan to Patricia Corrigan, Susan Sarandon, Because then you could do a whole thing of, well, nobody believes what she's saying because she's a woman in 1865. It would have worked well either way. And it just so happens that, you know, Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon were involved for several years. So that would be interesting as well, just for that idea. So Tim Robbins as Peter Corrigan. Now, for John Wilkes Booth slash Jonathan Wellington, I would cast Dan Levy as John Wilkes Booth slash, you know, Dan Levy, because he can do, I know you've seen him in Schitt's Creek. I know he's Eugene Levy's son. I get it. He's comedic, but he can also play dramatic as well. You may not know that from... necessarily know that from watching Schitt's Creek. If you haven't seen that show, by the way, fantastic show. Very funny. But I think Dan Levy would be great as the role of John Wilkes Booth. Now, for the desk sergeant at the police station, since the guy, you know, was sort of the way he was, Mike Myers, and I would put on an Irish accent. You know, just because. And then as William, the former attendant slash now generationally wealthy person, Mr. Bryan Cranston as William, because I think he has that sort of air about him to be just snooty enough to be able to put you in your place, but just nice enough to be likable. And he definitely possesses that quality on screen. And so that would be my picks. If you have different picks, email me, dimensionsteasypodcast@gmail.com, and let me know. Now, for the moral slash philosophy of this episode, I think we can chalk this one up to the idea of you can't change the past, and there's no use in dwelling upon it either. And this goes for historically as well as personally. You can't change what you've done in the past, and you can't change what anyone has done in the past. It's in the past. The only thing you can do is learn from it, try not to make the same mistake, and move forward. And I think that's good advice for any of us. Because all living in the past does is breed anxiety and all or breed depression, and all worrying about the future does is breed anxiety. And people today need neither of those. So that's what I think the moral of the philosophy of this episode is don't dwell on the past of things you can't change, because you can't change them. But just learn from your mistakes, or learn from the past. And move forward. Move forward without preconceived notions of what's going to happen. Because then you just have self-fulfilling prophecies, which puts you in depression and breeds anxiety as well. And that's good for no one. So, instead, don't worry about the past. Just learn from it and change the future in the best way you can. So, I think that'll about bring this one in for a landing. My apologies for taking a couple of weeks in between there. It was the holidays, and I got really busy at work, really busy with all the holiday merrymaking going on and all that. I wasn't able to get anything out in time, although despite my best thoughts and ideas to do so, it simply didn't happen, and I apologize for there being a lag of a few weeks in new episodes. But with that being said, stay tuned for next week's episode of The Twilight Zone, where you have a dishonest man that tries to do an honest thing. So stay tuned for one of the episodes that was shot on tape instead of film. And stay tuned for the whole truth. Thank you all for listening. I appreciate it so much. I think I'm up to 18 of you now. I love all of you. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good week, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye, everyone.